Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels at the Rainbow Soul channel on BlakeRadio.com. And tonight's topic is how you expect to heal when you're killing all the good guys. This crossed my mind, came to me, when I was sitting down thinking about all the things people were doing to try to get well. And thinking about all the things doctors did that made people be so much sicker. And then I was thinking, why is it that people cooperate and get involved in this? The answer is, people actually think that they're going to get better. They actually think that these chemicals, let's call them antibiotics, are going to kill the infection. And then they're going to heal. And, of course, this doesn't quite work out. How do we know that? We know it doesn't work because at least 99,000 people in 2012 died of infections with resistant bacteria. And so we know it doesn't work. And so the people who died of infection in all of 2012 without being afflicted with resistant bacteria. Well, it's a pretty small number, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000. So it's difficult to argue that antibiotics, or even increased antibiotic use, would be helpful. So the only thing that really ticked me off, there's a huge problem, even bigger than I might have imagined, was when I started working with Candida. This was way back in the dark ages, 1990-something. I guess you could say 93, 94 to be precise. I noticed, and Candida, of course, is absolutely the worst thing, because back then the miracle antifungals were just coming out. We were told that this was the best thing since sliced bread. One pill would cure you forever. And you can imagine, as doctors, just how excited we were about this. And so, of course, I started using them straight away. And at first, it seemed very promising. They were working, and then they worked less and less and less. And now, in 2014, many of these pills are being prescribed to be taken every day. And at between $10 and $30 a pill, it's pretty difficult. But even more than that, the premise that a chemical can cure a fungal infection is just simply false. And then the next premise, then, of course, was that a chemical could cure a bacterial infection. Because, of course, in many cases, especially in medicine, you got the fungal infection because you took the chemical, which is the antibiotic, for the bacterial infection. And so, of course, the bacterial or the chemical failed it failed because instead of curing your infection, it gave you another bothersome infection. And then many of us also are aware, women especially, with urinary tract infections, who take medicine after medicine after medicine and never get better. And so it occurred to me then that certainly these chemicals that we refer to as antibiotics were not life-saving, but were definitely life-destroying. And the life they destroyed was not the bacteria, but the human being who took it. But then something else troubled me tremendously, was women get something called urinary tract infections. These are caused or caused by something called E. coli. But wait, E. coli is a normal bacteria of the intestine. It belongs in your body. So how can you talk about killing E. coli? Because when you take an antibiotic, it goes everywhere in the body, not just to the bladder. So you're killing these E. coli that belong in your intestine. And so then I realized that something was very wrong with what I had been taught in medical school. And so what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to talk about normal healthy people, what bacteria normally belong in the body. I'm going to talk about the diseases, infectious diseases that people supposedly get, and the organisms they're blamed on, the strategies for treating them. New research showing this is a very bad thing to do. And finally, what would be a sensible strategy? And of course, it's natural. This solution is quite natural. So I was suspicious, and I had my doubts, and I was actually very concerned about it, so concerned that even prior to the year 2000, when I was still in medical practice, I stopped prescribing antibiotics. I could not in good conscience prescribe antibiotics when, to my observation, I had absolutely no evidence that they were effective. And so here it is, 2014. And actually, way back then, when in recent memory, we call it 2011 recent memory, there was a project that was done. It's called the Human Microbiome Project. And what better place than, of course, Baylor, Texas, with, of course, tremendous government funding. And what did they do? They took 600 people. First of all, they advertised. I was going to advertise. So we want healthy people, healthy, healthy people. So 600 people showed up and said, I and help it. So they didn't take the word for it. Instead, they did a bunch of blood tests, they did some exams, they interrogated and asked more questions, and finally we left with a group of about 300 people who were, 248 people who passed all of their screens and were certified healthy. And they then took these people and did a culture. That means they took a sample of whatever living organism might exist in their mouth, their rectum, that's the place where you poop, their skin, their nose, their eye fluid, vagina if they had one, men didn't have one, and armpits. And they took these samples of organisms and they put them on petri dishes in a laboratory to get them to grow. And these are the organisms that they found. By the way, we have a chat room going here, and they're very lively, with lots of comments. And that's healingwithdrdaniel.chatango.com. That's healing with Dr. Dr. is spelled D-R, Daniel.chatango.com. And if you would like to listen to the show on the telephone, then you can call 914-338-0695. And kind of the halfway mark, the last of that will take questions. Okay, great. Now, so they've got these people, 248. They cultured every single hole in their body. And this is what they found. 100% of healthy people had Bacteroides fragilis. Bacteroides fragilis is considered to be an annoying organism. Totally incurable if you have it, doesn't cause much trouble. And so doctors in modern times have thrown up their hands and refused to prescribe anything for it. Then there's Bacteroides melaninogenicus, 100% had that. Bacteroides oralis, 100% had that infection. But wait, 100% of people had Bacteroides. And so I had Enterococcus faecalis. Okay, so Enterococcus faecalis, what is that? I mean, an organism called Enterococcus, Enterococcus means round, Entero means intestine, so round intestinal bacteria, and faecalis means it's in the feces. Well, what human do you know does not have feces? Yes, but you got it. And so they have a fancy name called vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus. Now, these are bacteria, and this is from, the medical side, Medline. Enterococcus are bacteria that are normally present in the human intestine. Okay, normally, in the female genital tract, and are often found in the environment. These bacteria can sometimes cause infection. But now we've established they are normally present, which means people are sick. I think that's the campaign in the midst of the presidential election here in Canada. Every now and then, enthusiastic supporters will broadcast the virtues of their candidate. So we're going to let that pass. So vancomycin is an antibiotic that's used to treat some drug-resistant infections caused by Enterococcus. Now, I would like to suggest, this is my personal suggestion, this is not necessarily supported by research or what it might be, is that if we have an organism that's called Enterococcus, it's present in 100% of healthy people, and you see it laying around or present at the site of a so-called infection, it may not be the bad person. It may not be the responsible party. It may not be the proper place to direct one's negative energies, like antibiotics, for example. And to direct an antibiotic towards something called enterococci, which belongs in everyone's body and everyone's feces, is actually an act of war and can create death in the organism being so treated. In other words, giving antibiotics to a human being for enterococci that belongs or is normally present there is extremely, on the face of it, damaging. Okay, so what does the med guy say here? So vancomycin is an antibiotic that is used to treat some drug-resistant infections caused by enterococci. Sometimes enterococci become resistant to this drug, and these are called VRE, vancomycin-resistant enterococci. And they are very determined to treat this. Now, VRE, these resistant bugs, can live within human intestines and female genital tract without causing disease. Okay, so now we've found out these bacteria can live in the body, 100% of the healthy people, without causing disease, and even when they're resistant to drugs, they still don't cause disease. However, sometimes, they can cause infections in the urinary tract, the bloodstream, or wounds associated with catheters or surgical procedures. So wait a minute. So it seems to me it's the catheter and the surgical procedure that's the problem. That if the catheters are no longer used and the surgical procedures in question are not done, then we would not have a life-threatening situation. But this is not the reasoning process the medical profession has gone through. The medical profession has decided that since this normally occurring bacteria is found at the site of urinary catheter insertions in the bloodstream of people who've been sliced during surgical procedures, this organism must be a problem. This is like a police going to the scene of the crime and arresting the bystanders. Because they're standing there, they must have been responsible for the crime. And then locking them up. And, of course, not looking for any miscreant, of course, who's run away. Well, you guys are standing here. The bad guy's not, the person committed the crime may have fled the scene, but we know that you guys standing here offering assistance are, of course, guilty. We're going to lock you up and throw away the key. It's a similar process here. And so, the problem here is that we have an obvious good guy here, which is Enterococcus. It's being treated as a bad guy. And the antibiotics, vancomycin, used to treat this are very deadly, dangerous, and cause side effects like death, slowly permanent damage. So this whole philosophy of identifying disease is an issue. Then we have E. coli, again, present in 100% of healthy people. There's not a single healthy person that does not have E. coli. You have to conclude then that these bacteria that are present in 100% of people must be performing a useful function contributing to their health. And so what is happening is we're taking these bacteria that are obviously making a meaningful contribution to people's health, labeling them as disease-causing, then blasting them with chemicals designed to kill them and at the same time harm the human. And so E. coli is an excellent example of this. As I said, it's present in 50% of the time in healthy people. And women especially tend to have recurrent urinary tract infections. And so what could possibly cause E. coli to show up in the urine? Well, really two things. One is dehydration. It super concentrates the urine, so the E. coli concentration is higher. Where the lower E. coli concentration might be no problem at all. The E. coli would pass from the urine into the toilet without any symptoms. The other thing that could cause urinary tract infection is constipation. So constipation, the E. coli, which are sitting in the colon, leak out and find their way into the urinary tract. And so what does the medical profession say when they see E. coli in the urine? Instead of saying, oh, the body is trying to get rid of excess E. coli, let's give it some help, no. Instead, they administer a poison that kills all E. coli that are in the urinary tract and that are outside the urinary tract, such as in the intestines where they belong. And this causes a tremendous amount of problems in women. In the case of chronic bladder pain, and many women feel like they have a urinary tract infection, and they don't, and they keep taking more antibiotics and more antibiotics and more antibiotics. And what finally happens is the antibiotics stop working. That means the antibiotics stop giving even temporary relief from the pain. Why? Because the antibiotics acts were never the appropriate therapy in the first place. What was really happening was the body had an excess of E. coli in the form of constipation or an excess concentration of E. coli caused by dehydration, is trying to get rid of it. And rather than help the body get rid of the E. coli, the medical profession chooses to bombard the poor lady with antibiotics. How do we know this is the wrong therapy? Well, first of all, it doesn't work, so that would be one indication of therapy is incorrect. The second thing is the damage caused by the antibiotics and sometimes even death. Lately, women are being given long-term Cipro, and many people are aware that that causes tendon damage as well as emotional psychiatric damage as well. So this is a really bad deal. And what some other people do for urinary tract infections, just simply take D-mannose. What does D-mannose do? It allows the E. coli to detach from the bladder and slip away, and the episode passes. And so then, so that's the E. coli. Next we have Klebsiella. Klebsiella is very interesting because Klebsiella is considered to be a very, very bad actor. Now, 80% of healthy people have Klebsiella. That's a lot of people. 80% of people in this human biome project had Klebsiella on their body. And so let's take a look at what Medscape says about Klebsiella. Well, first of all, Klebsiella is notorious for causing pneumonia. That means that the bacteria Klebsiella are found in the lungs frequently, and the person has, of course, fever, cough, and infection in the lungs. And so Medscape says, treatment of carbapenem and antibiotic-resistant Klebsiella pneumonia. And they say the increasing incidence of carbapenem-resistant pneumonia fundamentally alters, and this changes, the management of patients at risk to be colonized or infected by such microorganisms. Now remember, as you read this, 80% of people have Klebsiella. So 80% of people are obviously at risk for having resistant Klebsiella because they're supposed to have Klebsiella in the first place. And they say, because of the limitation and effectiveness, that means it doesn't work, and potential for toxicity, that means it's dangerous and kills people, of the alternative agents, that means antibiotics, many experts recommend using combination therapy, that means more than one drug, instead of monotherapy. So wait, if the drugs are ineffective and dangerous, the solution is to use more of them. Okay. This is the reasoning process that leads to people dying from antibiotics, that leads to antibiotic resistance, that leads to death from methicillin or the creation even of methicillin resistant, vancomycin resistant, enterococcus resistant Klebsiella. So this, and this is the standard of care. This is not deviant doctor talk. This is not incompetent doctors overusing antibiotics. This is Medscape discussing the standard of care. So standard of care is you have an antibiotic, you've identified it as ineffective and dangerous, then you double up on it. You use two or three different types at one time. Okay. And we're saying in the absence of well-designed comparative studies, and if we have not studied this, we don't know what we're talking about, the best combination for each infection type remains an open question. So in other words, doctors, do whatever you want, use more antibiotics, and the more, the better. Obviously, a doctor reading this is saying, I guess I better start with two antibiotics, stick to the standard of care here so I don't get sued and I don't lose my license and I can pay on like very high educational loans. So with Klebsiella pneumonia, what we have then is a situation where dangerous, ineffective antibiotics are determined to be needed in combination more than one at a time. And we know that it's using more than one antibiotic at a time that causes resistance. So this is March 5th, 2013. Federal officials today warned of a new type of antibiotic resistance, more dangerous than MRSA, which is methicillin resistant. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But it can be curbed now with prompt action from health leaders, healthcare workers, and even patients. That means you're going to let patients help out with this one, which is really new. So it's primarily seen in patients who've been exposed to hospital settings. And these bacteria present a triple threat. And they're saying these include two common digestive system organisms, Klebsiella pneumonia, and they're mentioning E. coli. Resistance to nearly all antibiotics has a high mortality and invasive infection and can spread resistant genes to other bacteria to patients' bodies, CDC officials say. Let's figure this out now. Resistance is spread by plasmids, just by the way, it's a piece of protein. Could it be that the Klebsiella, the E. coli, and the staph are all good bacteria? And could it be that these plasmids are actually manufactured and produced by our own body to protect its own good bacteria, to save the lives of human beings who are being subjected to antibiotics that are killing their good bacteria? This is actually very likely, because these bacteria that are being killed are actually present in 80% of healthy people. And could it be what's causing the death of these people, these individuals, is the antibiotics themselves? Well, that's something, of course, that's not considered in the medical literature, or in this case by the CDC. So the CDC's director at that year, Tom Friedan, said in a briefing today, it is not often that scientists come to me and say, we need to sound an alarm. Now, this is obvious nonsense. If anyone turns on the 6 o'clock news, there's an alarm being sounded all the time, whether it's the alarm to get your flu shot, whether it's the alarm to vaccinate your kids, whether it's the alarm for a pandemic, there's constantly one alarm after another. But Tom Friedan says this is the first time anyone has ever asked him to sound an alarm. All right, we'll take his word. So CDC officials say basing their warnings on data from three surveillance systems, including one that showed the proportion of antibiotic-resistant organisms among all the Enterobacter increased from 1% to 4%. That's fourfold, which is a big increase, but it's still 4%. And again, I'm pointing out here that these Enterobacter is present in 100% of people. And it seems to me that the body might be trying to defend its good bacteria by conferring resistance on it. Interesting. And that's, of course, notorious Staph aureus, which has been credited with 49,000 deaths in the year 2012. So Staph aureus, 50% of all Americans were healthy, certified healthy, have staph living on their skin. This is normal. And according to Medline News, or Medical News Today, Staph aureus is a group of bacteria that live on the surface of people's skin. Yep, they agree with that. And inside the nose, it's normally harmless. Most people who are carrying it are totally unaware they have it. In fact, up to 50% of the general population carries it in the nose and skin. This group of bacteria can be spread quite easily from person to person through contact. Well, wait a minute. If 50% have it already, then what's the worry about catching it? I mean, half of all healthy people have it. So you're going to spread it to more people, and more people will be healthy than that. So this is clearly, a alarmist wording here. Most healthy people have strong immune systems and can fight off a staph infection themselves. Now, again, healthy people have staph everywhere all over their skin. However, people with weakened immune systems or who have undergone surgery, for example, heart surgery or hip replacement, can develop more serious problems in more vulnerable people, and staph aureus bacteria have been known to cause boils, abscesses, impetigo, these are all bumps on the skin that hurt, septic wounds, heart valve problems, and toxic shock syndrome. In extreme cases, it can result in death. Okay. In the United States, we have a lot of these extreme cases, 49,000 to be precise. So this is really shocking that these healthy, good bacteria have been blamed for so much. And it's been used as a pretense to douse and inundate the human body with poisonous chemicals called antibiotics. And what these chemicals are really killing is the human organism itself. These antibiotics have been proven to be dangerous to the liver, dangerous to the kidneys, and leading to death, and even toxic to the brain, causing people to commit suicide. So the antibiotics have a track record, and the track record is of death. Okay, so that's fine. Let's drop our number again here. The call-in number is 914-338-0695. We'll be taking questions in about 15 minutes. And our chat room is healingwithdrdaniels.chattangle.com. All right, so what to do? Now, first I'm going to tell you what Michael Pullen, he's a professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. And he looked over all this stuff, and I'll see what he figured out. And then I'll tell you what I actually did that worked very well. And I just, like I said, stopped using antibiotics totally and completely. Just gave it up, bad habit, worse than cigarettes or alcohol. So what to do? Now, so what Michael did was he interviewed a Dr. Sonnenberg. And what Sonnenberg said was, hey, you know, it looks like this. Exposure to environmental microbes likely decreases the chances of many Western diseases, but increases pathogen exposure. Well, yeah, so exposure to environmental microbes decreases chances of diseases, but increases, he says, in this case he says pathogen exposure, that means disease-causing microbes. And so it says probably unwise to not thoroughly wash your produce, although that would help you get good bacteria from the soil, which people desperately need. However, the pesticide residues make this unwise. And he's saying here, Western diseases can be prevented instead by eating a variety of whole grains and a diverse diet of plants and vegetables as well as fruits. There's a lot of controversy about this in the alternative field, but we're going further. The safest way to increase your microbial biodiversity is to eat a variety of polysaccharides, he said. Now, these polysaccharides are sugars linked together in fiber, and they're not digestible to humans because humans don't have the enzymes it takes to digest them. But the good bacteria do. I should say the diverse bacterial biome do have the enzymes needed. And so when you eat foods that are filled with this fiber that's digestible not by humans but by these microorganisms, then you feed them, and you feed them, they multiply, and they help you. The big problem with the Western diet, Mr. O'Keefe said, is it does not feed the gut, only the upper GI, known as small intestine of the stomach. All the food has been processed to be readily absorbed, leaving nothing to the lower GI, the large intestine. But it turns out that one of the keys to health is fermentation in the large intestine. In other words, you want fermentation in the large intestine, instead of what many health gurus have talked about, which is no fermentation. And the key to feeding the fermentation in the large intestine is feeding it lots of plants with their various types of fiber, including resistant starch found in bananas, oats, and beans, for example, and soluble fiber in onions, other root vegetables, and nuts, and insoluble fiber in whole grains, especially bran. And bran, by the way, is wheat bran, rice bran, oat bran. And they recommend avocados, although I find that avocados are pretty heavy and greasy for most people who are trying to heal from something. But if you're in perfect health, avocados are fine. So he said, with our diet of swiftly absorbed sugars and fats, we're eating for the upper intestines and depriving the trillion of bacteria, our good bacteria, the food they like best, which is complex carbohydrates and fermentable plant fibers. The byproduct of fermentation is the short-chain fatty acids that nourish the gut barrier and help prevent inflammation. And there are studies suggesting that simply adding plants to a fast food diet will mitigate its inflammatory effects. I'll put that in English. I found when I was practicing medicine that I could take people who had absolutely lousy diets, I do mean lousy diets, and simply add a vegetable to their diet and they felt much better. Now, I didn't cure them, but they weren't looking for a cure, they just wanted to feel better. Because they explained to me, Dr. Daniels, I am not going to give up my fast food. It's okay, fine, have some broccoli. They add broccoli to their diet. It would make them feel so much better. They would get more energy. They would do little things like walk around the block, and they felt a lot better. And they needed fewer drugs. And so perfection is not necessarily, is not needed. It can just move in a better direction. And so we outlined the diet for the new superorganism. And that new superorganism would be the new superhuman being. We're becoming clear and did not require administrations of the food scientists at Nestle or General Mills. I'm quoting this, it's not me talking. Big food and big pharma probably do have a role to play, as will Jeffrey Gordon's next generation synbiotics in repairing the microbiota of people who can't or don't care to simply change their diets. Okay, so what's he saying here? Put in very plain English. They're taking the findings from the human microbiome study, finding out which microorganisms are prevalent in healthy people, and putting them into a pill. And so the author here says, this is going to be big business. Yep. The components of a microbiota-friendly diet are already on the supermarket shelves and in farmers' markets. And so the diet is less processed, so that more of it gets safely through the gastrointestinal tract and into the eager clutches of the microorganisms, I'm putting that in English for you, of the large intestine. It's a striking idea that one of the keys to good health may turn out to involve managing our internal fermentation. Having recently learned to manage several external fermentations of bread and kimchi and beer, I know a little about the details of that process. So he says you depend on the microbes and you do your best to align their interests with yours, mainly by feeding them the kinds of things they like to eat. Absolute control of the process is too much to hope for. A lot like gardening, not governing. And so what is the next step here? If people are literally going to sell you a pile of feces in a pill. Yeah. What they're going to say is human beings have to go to Big Pharma or Big Food to buy these members of the microbiome. But we know where these organisms are. These organisms are in the feces, the armpits, the nose of healthy people. That's where these good bacteria are. So if you think you need good bacteria, I guess you could go to the store and buy some. But why not find someone that you believe to be healthy and ask if you borrow some of their good bacteria? Simple, cheap, inexpensive, takes nerve, but hey, that's the truth. That takes nerve. But what's going on here then is many infections that humans have, Klebsiella pneumonia, E. coli urinary tract infection, Enterobacter sepsis, all of these are being attributed to what we now know to be good bacteria, bacteria that are present in healthy people. And what are these infections treated with? Treated with dangerous drugs. With what degree of success? Not much. Lots of death. And so it seems to me it might actually be the antibiotics that are causing the death. Now, like I said, I've noticed this in my medical practice when I prescribe antibiotics, which is part of why I stopped prescribing them. All the standard antibiotics were not working. Drug reps stopped buying. Hey, Dr. Gano, we have this new whiz-bang antibiotic. Try this antibiotic. And by the way, here's a nice marble chest set. Well, okay, let me try this antibiotic. I prescribed the antibiotic that day, 2 a.m. that morning. I got a frantic phone call from my patient telling me that she felt like she was dying. Don't take another one of antibiotics. Drink some water. I'll see you in the office tomorrow. By morning, she felt perfectly okay. She says, Dr. Gaines, I feel great. Can I start the antibiotic again? I said, no, you may not. I said, you never killed you. And so this got me to thinking. Antibiotics were not food today. What did I figure out? I figured out that if you got a person to remove the excess organisms from their body and drink more water and improve the nutrition, boom. 100% of the infections on the list. I really stopped antibiotics. There were people who came to me. They had fever. One guy had fever. Boils all over his body. He was ready to check out. I said, you know what? Let's just stop all these antibiotics. Let's stop the antibiotics. Take this. Poop some more. Back. Take this and do enema. Drink some water. And I see you back in 2 days. In 2 days. More than half of his boils were gone. Fever was gone. He was feeling great. And I stopped the antibiotics. And from that point, I never was sick. I said, these antibiotics are too dangerous. They're killing people. They're ruining people. And they're not helping the infection. And so, whether it's a sinus infection, you can use a neti pot with salt water, rinse the bacteria out of the sinuses. Whether it's an intestinal infection, you can do an enema, just rinse those bugs right out of the intestine. If it's a fever that you have, in terms of your blood, the quickest way to handle that is to drink a tea like ginger tea or tea with a pinch of cayenne in it or mint. All of these teas help you sweat. And then you drink water, bundle up in a few layers of blankets, and you'll sweat. All the excess bacteria will be dumped out on your skin, and you'll be fine. You can repeat that obviously as much as you want, what do you think? And so what I found then was there really wasn't any place for the antibiotics. Urinary tract infection, drink more water, and, take some D-mannose, rinse the bacteria, just rinse it right out. It's simply a rinse job. It's getting rid of these infections is a simple rinse job, and instead we've gotten a con job. And it's really absolutely shocking and very unfortunate. Now, for more information, please go to vitalitycapsules.com/cures-file, box upper right corner there, enter your email address, and you'll get your free report on taking care of infections without antibiotics. Help you avoid the kill pill. Well, let me just take a look here. See if we have any questions. There's no questions. So if you have questions, you can just click the thing on your phone there and answer questions.
Hi, Dr. Daniels. How are you?
Mm-hmm. I'm fine.
I have a question. My husband has been having gallbladder attacks, and we know what we shouldn't do. But what's the best way to handle those? He's been doing turpentine and some liver flushes for a few months now, but this came on just a couple weeks ago, and we're just trying to keep it under control with limited food and just the right foods. But I was curious what you would have to say about that.
Okay. A lot of times people who have gallbladder problems, especially if they do liver flushes, if they do liver flushes and then between liver flushes, they don't do much, and then they do another liver flush. The problem with liver flushes is part of the liver flush is a step in there where you actually soften the gallstones. You want it all nice and soft, and they slip and slide through the tubes, and the gallstones come out during the flush itself. In between the liver flush, those softened stones become hard again. And so if you don't flush every single month, then your body cycles. Even then, body cycle. So at the end of the month, from the first flush, your body will say, oh, man, let's flush again. And it'll push those stones through the bile tubes. Only this time, they're not soft because you didn't soften them up because you didn't have a liver flush plan. And so the person then is in constant pain. They're like, what's going on? I did the liver flush. So what do you do if you have gallstones? Or say if you have gallstones, then you know it, what do you do? The simplest thing is to attack the gallstones at the cause. What's the cause of gallstones? It's dehydration, very low bile flow. So you improve your bile flow. The next cause is relative constipation. It means just increase the number of bowel movements. So I've had people get rid of their gallbladder situation just by taking vitality tests, just by pooping 3 or 4 times a day. And these people haven't been stellar dietary adherence. They usually say, okay, fine. I'll eat some green beans. Usually green beans or broccoli seems to be the two popular vegetables among non-vegetable eaters. So they'll eat green beans, add that to their diet, and they'll just take vitality capsules so they poop more often and they'll drink more water. That's the shortcut, because we're guessing that your husband's not perfect. I mean, in order to get gallstones, there's a lot of things that have to go wrong at the same time. So there's a lot going on. And if he's taking any kind of prescription drugs of any kind, he's got to get a plan for cutting that down. Because most prescription drugs are partly disposed of in the liver. This means they actually clog up the bile ducts and clog up the liver. And they contribute to gallstones just by the fact that they have to be disposed of and increases the disposal burden of the liver. Many blood pressure drugs, for example, do this. So it's really difficult. So you may want to send an email to Gabriel at support@vitalitycapsules.com. Put discovery session there as a subject line. And she'll tell you about, being able to talk to me to see if you want personal one-on-one guidance to help guide your husband out of this maze of sickness and misery that he's found himself in. And I can't help everybody, but I can help some people. And so look into that and see. Generally, depending on the plan, prices are anywhere from $5,000 to $7,000, and there are some lower end group plans as well. All right, so we have some questions here in the chat room. One person says, what's the thing cured my gallbladder attack? Any information on this? Yes. Again, the problem with the gallbladder in terms of gallbladder attack is that the stuff going through your tube is not liquid. It becomes hardened, it becomes stiff, the tubes have become blocked. Lecithin is a lubricant, and lecithin also helps dissolve and emulsify stones. So yes, lecithin is a good thing to take. This person took only 1,200 milligrams, but usually it's more than that. I usually recommend 15 grams of the tablespoon. And in the old days, it was soy lecithin. Now you can get sunflower lecithin, stuff that's not genetically modified. And my question is, Dr. Daniels, are you suggesting people might need a soil transplant? That's an interesting question. The gut and the intestines have often been referred to as soil, the soil of the body. And now the medical establishment is doing experiments with transplants called fecal transplants. They actually transplant feces from a healthy person to a diseased person. And they are finding this is clearing up a lot of problems. Now, I personally think it's a fantastic idea. I know people who have actually benefited from this. But again, it takes nerve, it takes courage, and it takes really disregarding a lot of stuff that the medical profession has told you. So now what the medical profession is coming out with is the federal government is issuing guidelines to regulate this process. And the federal government is also giving authorization to certain companies to literally sell human feces. And so I don't know how they're going to outlaw a healthy person sharing their feces with someone else who's not healthy. But stay tuned for that. Okay, we have other questions. Is there actually any evidence that colds or flu are infectious? Okay, that's an interesting question. Again, you have to say what is evidence. And if you want to take as evidence conscious, so you take someone who has the infection, let's say a urinary tract infection, and E. coli in their urine by that test, and you ask yourself, do they have symptoms of a urinary tract infection? And the answer is no. Not everyone who has a positive urine analysis has symptoms. And then the next question is, are there people who have symptoms of a urinary tract infection? They have the urgency, they have the burning, everything you can think of, but have a negative test. And the answer is absolutely yes. In fact, half of all women who have urinary tract infection symptoms do not have a positive culture, don't have evidence of infection. So if you use just that example of conscious postulates, is there disease in the presence of the disease-causing organisms? The answer is no. And is the person absent the organism? Are the symptoms absent? The answer is no. So for urinary tract infection, actually, conscious postulates actually fail. Very interesting. That's a good question. Okay, we have another question online here on the telephone.
Jennifer?
Are you in the air? Yes.
Hi, what about root canal, dental root canals and the use of antibiotics after they're done?
Are you saying, does that make sense? Is that sensible? Is it beneficial?
Should it be done or should you ignore the antibiotic that dentists normally give you for a root canal? You know, or are there alternatives? Or?
Okay, yeah, I'll answer that question. The answer is there are alternatives. And again, the antibiotic the doctor is giving you, he is giving you an antibiotic for something you don't have. In other words, you don't have an infection. And so he's giving you the antibiotic to prevent an infection. And more information is emerging that you absolutely should not give antibiotics to prevent an infection. And so what we do know is that the antibiotic does destroy these good bacteria. And we're talking about the Klebsiella. We're talking about the Enterococcus, we're talking about the staph. These are organisms that are present in healthy people and they are serving a function. Just because scientists haven't figured out what the function is doesn't mean it's not there. So when the doctor gives you an antibiotic, it is destroying your beneficial bacteria, for sure, we know that. What we don't know that it's preventing an infection. So what do you do then if you don't want it to destroy your immune system, which is what these bacteria are, to cause your immune system? You don't want to destroy your immune system, but on the other hand, you don't want to get infected. And so the thing to do then would be to realize that what has happened when you have a root canal is the doctor has disturbed your tissue and created a breach in your immune system and created an opportunity for infection. And so what you need to do is you need to increase your fluids. You need to make sure you're doing enemas or increasing your bowel movements, and maybe take some garlic. The root canal is pretty close to the brain, so I take a higher dose of garlic, like 3 capsules 4 times a day. It's a pretty high dose. Not safe to take if you're taking blood thinners. This is not medical advice. Listen at your own risk. So those are the things you want to do. And any time that you're at risk for an infection, you want to increase your hydration, increase your output of feces, so any organisms that would have caused an infection instead leave your body. And then third, take a mild herbal antibiotic. Actually, garlic is not mild, but again, the root canal, talking about next to the brain. So definitely do that. Okay, so what else do we have here? Okay. So another question in the chat room is, should you put oil of oregano on the wound in your mouth? I say no. I think oil of oregano is just like torture. It's way, way, way too painful. So I would not do that. I would lean towards clove oil in the mouth because it's actually anesthetic. It numbs the gums, and it's going to increase your comfort. So I would lean towards clove oil. It's a powerful antimicrobial, and it'll add to your comfort by numbing your gums. Have you found negative results on the gut flora by using grapefruit seed extract? No, because I don't use grapefruit seed extract. It's just not something I've had to resort to. I generally solve whatever the problem is without grapefruit seed extract. Okay. Another question, have viruses been blamed for diseases? Have any of the viruses blamed for disease been isolated and photographed? Answer is yes. The viruses that have been blamed for the common cold, I should say the seasonal flu, supposedly have been isolated and have been photographed. And the question is, are they responsible for the seasonal flu? The answer is probably not, because each year they tell us that the viruses they thought were responsible actually were not responsible. And I've been involved with medicine since 1984, and they've never guessed right a single year since that point on the vaccine, even though the flu vaccine is supposedly effective against 23 different strains of flu. It boggles my mind how they could not have possibly guessed right even 1 year out of the last, 30 or so years. So I would have to certainly call that into question. Okay. Can you talk more about antibiotic resistance that occurs quickly? Okay, yeah. Antibiotic resistance, the way we were taught in medical school, is antibiotic resistance is created from repeated exposure to antibiotics. In other words, you cannot get antibiotic resistance without exposing the microbial or that bacteria to antibiotics. This was the case many years ago. Now what we're seeing is resistance develop very, very quickly. So on the first exposure to antibiotics, resistance is happening. And this suggests another mechanism at work here. In other words, it suggests the plasmid theory, which was proposed many years ago, and that is simply that this protein is shared from bacteria to bacteria. Bacteria gets this protein and makes that bacteria that organism resistant. It makes about a million copies, releases them to other bacteria, and the resistance spreads literally in hours. And so you don't need to have another generation of bacteria. It doesn't become a genetic event to get resistance. And this has really made resistance happen very, very quickly. And again, that kind of begs the theory that I mentioned, which is that could your body be promoting resistance because it's defending these bacteria that are actually good bacteria and actually cause the immune system could it be your body's fight to live? And when we bombard your body with antibiotics to fight this resistance, what's really happening is the human is being murdered. Okay. Another question? Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, do you have a question? Yeah?
Oh, yes. What have you ever experienced any of your patients who, like, I have noticed that my urine has been really foamy. It's been like a couple of years now, but my physicians haven't been able to pick up anything. But it just seemed unusual to me. It'll just be foamy, and it'll stay foamy for, you know, minutes.
But it foams each time you urinate.
Pardon me?
It foams each time you urinate?
Yeah. Each time, it'll just, the foam will sit, and it'll break down slowly over maybe 10 minutes or so.
Okay, got it. Yes, I have seen that in patients. And basically, there's something in your diet your body's trying to get rid of, and so it's a dietary issue. And as soon as you change your diet, the foaming will go away. So it's a matter of figuring out what it is in your diet that's causing that foaming. One last question. Okay, your question? Hi, you on the air?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi. I have a quick question. Actually, really two of them. And I was listening to your broadcast about a week ago, I believe, about turpentine. And I'm actually on your Vitality Capsules. It's working very well, and I'm getting ready to, I guess, purchase turpentine probably this weekend. And I wanted to know, like, I have a 5-year-old and a 12-year-old that I would like to get them on it as well. Is that possible? And then my second question to you is, what is your intake on the, the food-grade certified hydrogen peroxide?
Okay, all right. I'll answer both of those pretty quickly. The kids, 5 and 12, turpentine dose is weight-dependent. The best way to get more information on that is to send an email, support@vitalitycapsules.com, and Gabriel will help you out with getting the official document that goes into great detail about all of that. Food-grade hydrogen peroxide, you know, personally, I just use the plain 3% stuff out the grocery store. I know that's heresy. But I have purchased the stronger 35% stuff, but my preference is just the regular stuff. And I don't use it that often. It's not much case to use it. I find that the turpentine really does the trick. Okay, so that brings us to the end of the show. We have very few seconds left. So I'd like to encourage people to definitely go to vitalitycapsules.com/truth-files. And get their life-saving report. Herbal remedies so powerful they make antibiotics obsolete. Find in that upper right corner there. Very important. Vitality Capsules production, yay, moving along. Label finalized, production finalized. So the label should be finished in 2 days. We should be able to get those capsules finished in the next week. So very exciting. I will keep you posted. Okay, so we will see you next week. Wait, I got something.